Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. In this edition, we have a file by correspondent Emily Schwing from Central Washington University's Brewing Research Lab. Students can earn a certificate in craft brewing or go for a full Bachelor of Science in the Art of Brewing. We'll hear about the grains, the warts, the sugars, the whole kit and caboodle in the second half of the show. But first, we'll hear stories about power companies energizing more than just the lights or the stove. Oregon's Pacific Power and Portland General Electric may be joining forces with companies in California and Washington to go into the car charging business. This is The Bridge for the week of October 20th. Austin Jenkins reports from Western Washington. 10 counties get their electric power or natural gas or both from Puget Sound Energy. The state's largest utility company also helps power campaigns and elections in Washington through political contributions.
Puget Sound Energy and its predecessors have a 135-year history, from building the region's first hydroelectric dam at Snoqualmie Falls
in one of the roughest countries man ever tried to conquer,
to Puget Sound Power and Light's role in keeping the lights on through the Great Depression. From the arrival of natural gas in the 1950s all the way to the first wind facilities in 2005.
These windmills, when you go out and see them, are really quite amazing.
Today, PSE is a privately held company whose ownership group includes foreign investors, but its headquarters remain in Bellevue, and it's regulated by Washington's Utilities and Transportation Commission. That helps explain why the company is an active player in state politics.
I think from a company perspective, we believe civic involvement is important, and part of that civic involvement is political involvement.
That's Nancy Atwood, who heads up state government relations for PSE. Since 1997, the company has contributed more than $4 million to Washington campaigns and elections. Some of PSE's biggest spending has gone to defeat local public power initiatives that threaten its service areas. So far this election cycle, the utility has made nearly $250,000 in political contributions, mostly to individual candidates for the legislature, both Democrats and Republicans. But it's also written some bigger checks, including $30,000 to Enterprise Washington, a business-backed political action committee that's worked to keep a Republican majority in the state Senate.
We do give to Enterprise Washington, which is a business group. We also give to Democratic organizations as well. It's not as much about a party affiliation as it is about sharing the goals that we have for our customers.
Atwood says those goals include providing safe, dependable, and efficient energy at reasonable prices, while also looking to the region's future energy needs. It's not just campaigns and elections that PSE is involved with. The company also has a strong lobbying presence in the halls of the state capitol. Earlier this year, the Washington legislature passed a law that creates a funding mechanism for PSE to wean itself from coal-fired power in Montana. It took two legislative sessions and complex negotiations to hammer out the final bipartisan deal. Through it all, Doug Howell with the Sierra Club says he was reminded of PSE's political firepower.
They had a very big team, and sometimes when they would congregate after a hearing, you would see eight of them huddled.
Howell offers praise for PSE in the negotiations, but he anticipates future political fights with the company over natural gas, which he calls as bad as coal when it comes to climate change. In fact, a couple of years ago, Washington lawmakers passed favorable tax legislation for Puget Sound Energy to build a liquefied natural gas plant at the Port of Tacoma. It was another example of the kind of influence the company has in Olympia.
Yeah, I mean, they literally, you know, found me, might have pulled me off the floor. And
this is Democratic State Representative Jake Fye recalling how a lobbyist for PSE tracked him down at the end of the 2014 legislative session. He says the lobbyist was concerned that the tax bill for the new natural gas plant was about to be amended to death in the Washington House.
They came to me and asked me if I could help facilitate getting to the finish line.
Fye had received political contributions from Puget Sound Energy, but he says that's not why he agreed to help. Fye represents Tacoma and has a background in energy issues. He viewed the liquefied natural gas project as good for his district and good for the environment because it would allow ships leaving the port to burn cleaner fuel. A deal was hammered out, and on the next to last day of the legislative session, an amended version of the bill made it through.
Mr. President, 43 yeas, 6 nays.
It wasn't everything PSE had wanted, but it was still a significant win, especially for a short 60-day session when most tax-related bills weren't going anywhere. More recently, PSE has joined a lawsuit challenging Governor Jay Inslee's new carbon cap rule. The company also put $25,000 into a campaign to defeat a carbon tax initiative on the November ballot. These are positions that potentially put PSE at odds with its politically liberal and environmentally minded customer base in the Puget Sound region. The company says it supports reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but in a fashion that's cost effective. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Oregon's two biggest electric utilities, Portland General Electric and Pacific Power, may soon join Spokane-based Avista Utilities, Seattle City Light, and Northern California's Pacific Gas and Electric to try a new line of business, charging electric cars. They have plans to buy and maintain significant numbers of electric car charging stations. These will be installed at homes, private workplaces, and public locations. Correspondent Tom Bonsi has more.
We start with an automotive version of the chicken and egg thing. If there aren't charging stations out and about, people will be reluctant to buy electric cars. Yet no one wants to build charging stations unless the users are out there. This could describe the Inland Northwest situation. Now add in Avista Utilities, the biggest electricity provider in eastern Washington and North Idaho. Rendell Farley manages electric transportation initiatives for Avista, and he sees the potential to change the equation to the company's and society's benefit.
We've got potentially here a great opportunity to basically save money over gasoline, become less dependent on it, and keep those local dollars, those savings, in the local economies that can have a ripple effect. That's a big deal.
Avista is recruiting homeowners, employers, and scouting public locations to host more than 200 electric car charging stations. The utility has budgeted $3 million, which it hopes to recover in its rates, to build and maintain a charging network. On the other side of the state, Seattle City Light has plans to deploy 20 public fast chargers next year. Separately, it's working on how to provide utility-owned home charging stations as a service. Portland General Electric and Pacific Power face a year-end deadline to tell the state of Oregon how they plan to advance transportation electrification. Back at Avista, Farley describes his company's venture into electric car charging as more of a learning exercise than a profit center in the near term.
So in the next 5 to 10 years, we don't expect a material impact from electric vehicle adoption in our area. But longer term beyond that, it could have significant effects. And so it's very timely and important for us to start getting ahead of that now.
Avista needed to convince the Washington Utilities Commission that the pilot project was prudent. The commissioners raised questions about fair competition and ratepayer impacts, but eventually gave the green light. Utility Commission Chairman David Danner wants to see if smart integration of those big batteries in electric cars could support more efficient use of the electric grid.
The goal here isn't to give more money to people who can afford Teslas. From our point of view, the goal is how do we improve the electric infrastructure in this state?
Danner says even if you don't own an electric car, you have reasons to care. One of them is the high cost of building power plants.
Because if we can do this effectively, then you're going to be able to avoid building new generation resources that are going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars. And that is going to save you money.
Private enterprises already operate in the vehicle charging space, mainly in the I-5 corridor. I drove just over a mile from my office in Olympia over to the county courthouse and found an empty space in front of a charging station. Over here, looking at the control screen on this unit, it says 50 cents per hour to charge, all major credit cards accepted. This charging station is operated by a California-based company called ChargePoint, where Dave Packard serves as Vice President of Utility Solutions. Packard told me he welcomes deep-pocketed competitors into the market, but discourages them from owning and operating the charging equipment.
You know, if utilities get involved, because they don't move that quickly in deploying hardware that they own and operate, I hate to see a situation where that technology is obsolete.
Broadly speaking, Packard says the more charging stations there are, the more drivers will be comfortable in driving electric, and that will help overall adoption of plug-in cars. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
A federal magistrate judge has sided with environmental groups over stream conditions for threatened fish in Oregon. The dispute involves more than a dozen watersheds, including the Willamette, Rogue, and Middle Columbia. Judge John Acosta found that federal and state officials are allowing high stream temperatures to persist in violation of the Clean Water Act. A previous opinion struck down the rules regulators should use to allow warmer water. Nina Bell directs Northwest Environmental Advocates, the group leading the legal challenge.
Oregon had used this rule to change the temperature standards from temperatures that would normally protect salmon, steelhead, and bull trout to temperatures that were the equivalent of 90 degrees Fahrenheit, a temperature that is lethal to cold water fish within minutes.
Judge Acosta issued recommendations, not a ruling. It will be up to a federal district court judge to rule. In other environmental news, sensitive flora and fauna in southern Oregon and northern California could get additional protections under a proposal to expand the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument. The public had a chance to voice their opinions. April Ehrlich was there.
More than 400 people crammed into an auditorium at Southern Oregon University to discuss the proposal. Oregon Senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden are proposing to double the size of the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument, from about 66,000 acres to more than 130,000. The area is at the crossroad of several major ecosystems and is valued for its exceptional biodiversity. Supporters argue restricting land use will protect sensitive species as they adapt to climate change. Dr. Pepper Trail was on the science team that evaluated the area for additional protections.
Based on a foundation of solid science, now is the time for expansion of the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument to enable spatially comprehensive, cohesive, and consistent protection of this unique and precious landscape.
Elected officials from Jackson, Klamath, and Siskiyou counties criticized the proposal. They fear the expansion would hinder ranching, farming, timber harvest, and other economic activity. Ashland resident Steve Ritchie is a Republican candidate for a seat in the Oregon legislature. He said the plan would unfairly shut people out.
Further restrictions only deny citizens and taxpayers the opportunities they have always had to hunt, camp, and recreate.
A national monument designation, or expansion, has to be authorized by the president. After the meeting, Senator Merkley noted that Deputy Interior Secretary Michael Connor was sitting with him during the public testimony.
I wanted to make sure, absolutely sure, that the president's team heard directly from the citizens with the full spectrum of thoughts, and I think that was largely heard today.
Merkley said that, unlike wilderness designations, national monument rules are flexible and can be designed in a variety of ways to accommodate local concerns. If President Obama is going to sign off on expanding the monument, he's going to have to do it quickly. He leaves office on January 20th. I'm April Ehrlich reporting.
I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
You're listening to The Bridge. Now correspondent Emily Schwing takes us to Central Washington University.
A degree program in craft brewing beer is in its second year. Beer school graduates are in high demand in a market that's growing rapidly.
Every Wednesday night, students at Central Washington University meet in the school's brewing research lab. Some of them are pursuing a certificate in craft brewing. Others are chasing a full-blown Bachelor of Science degree in the subject.
It smells so nice.
Megan Myers has just learned how to grind grain to the right size in order to maximize what's called efficiency in beer speak.
The size of the grain is really important, because if it's too small, then it's all going to get stuck together in a ball and you won't have the enzymes breaking down the starches like you need to. But if it's too big, the sugars aren't exposed.
They're making a sweet liquid called wort from ground-up grain. The next step is to boil it to extract the sugars. Many of these students, like Matt Jacoby, have dabbled in the science of brewing at home.
All I've ever seen is just people doing it online and just kind of learning from what they're doing, but it's all a whole lot of new stuff to me.
Jacoby finished his bachelor's degree in criminal justice 10 years ago, but he enjoyed brewing beer in his kitchen so much that he opted to complete the program's 12 prerequisite classes in chemistry, physics, math, and economics.
This program is great for being able to meet local brewers and local companies that that need people, you know, with an education in how this stuff works.
In fact, program director Steve Wagner says whether students complete a certificate or the bachelor's degree, the school can't meet the market's demand for brewers.
Basically, breweries contact us pretty often looking for students to work at breweries, and we can't fulfill all the placements. This is a really good time to be a craft brewing student and to get jobs.
According to the Brewers Association, there are nearly 4,300 craft breweries operating in the United States, a number that rose 15% between 2014 and 2015 alone. Wagner says it's his personal goal to have a Central Washington graduate working at every brewery in the country. Currently, he says alumni work at 50 of them.
Yeah, actually, we have a lot of students that work as brewers. So the head brewer of No Lie graduated from our program 2 years ago.
Yeah, my name's Ryan Brookhart. I'm the head brewer here at No Lie Brew House.
Brookhart is responsible for 16 beers on tap at No Lie, one of the larger breweries in Spokane. The full-blown degree wasn't offered when he studied craft brewing at Central. He's considered going back just to learn a little more.
You know, anything from mechanical to electrical to plumbing to name it, pretty much.
All the stuff that when you go to the bar and you're actually drinking beer, you never think of.
No, and that's what's great about it. I mean, there's actually a huge amount of work and research, you know, behind all of it.
There are 23 university-affiliated brewing programs in the United States. Two of those are offered in the Northwest, here at Central Washington University, and another at Oregon State University in Corvallis. Back in the brewing research lab, the wort is nearly done. But there's still plenty of work ahead for Megan Myers. She relocated from Brooklyn specifically for this program. Currently, she's pursuing a certificate, but she's hopeful about completing the degree. That could cost between $16,000 and $35,000.
Financially, it's a bit tricky, but as far as having an extra leg up, compared to everyone else who's trying to potentially get a job in a brewery or open their own brewery, I think that it puts us in a really good place.
Good enough to sing about.
Row, row, row your oats, barley too, row too. Sometimes you add rye and wheat. We'll make beer for you. Woo!
In Ellensburg, I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
That was beautiful.
It was good, yeah.
I guess that's the class theme song now.
Recently, corporate labels including Miller Coors and Anheuser-Busch have been acquiring independent breweries throughout the Northwest. It's an increasingly familiar story. Small craft breweries draw fans, they expand, and then they get scooped up by
big beer.
That's right. I said
big beer.
Ace reporter Brian Bull has the beer beat. He takes us to Southern Oregon, where we find the response to
Big Beer
is as complex and varied as Imperial IPA.
A clear summer night finds a crowd at the Steel Pail Growler Station in Eugene. Chicago brewery Goose Island is here for its Migration Week, an event that lets people sample beer and meet staffers, including
Patrick Reich, and I am the lead cellarman at Goose Island.
Reich has been with the company 7 years, so he experienced Goose Island's $39 million acquisition by Anheuser-Busch in 2011.
We were probably one of the first, if not the first, of the craft breweries getting bought out and everything. A lot of people, they were upset at first, and then after the dust settled a bit, realized pretty much we were just still going to be making the same beer that we had always been making.
Anheuser-Busch took over production of Goose Island's large volume brands outside of Chicago. This includes Honker's Ale, 312, and IPA. The trick being taking a beer formerly made in 50-barrel batches and ratcheting that up to 1,000-barrel batches. Patron Alyssa Powell says both the acquisition and upscaling of Goose Island's beers are working.
I am drinking the IPA.
And how's the faring by you?
Oh, it's great. I also think it's kind of a positive because they get more access to different distributors. They can have more visibility in retail space, just get their product out there to more customers.
A few tables away, Tyler McNeil tackles a flight of Goose Island brews.
I've enjoyed most of it. I mean, some of it's hit and miss, but as long as they're keeping unique and doing their own thing, as long as the major label they signed with let them keep doing that, I don't see a big problem in it at all.
The Chicago Tribune recently rated 6 Goose Island beers mass-produced by Anheuser-Busch. It rated 4 as either top-tier or not bad. The last 2 fell short of previous incarnations. McNeil doesn't knock Goose Island, but admits some bitterness at Seattle-based Elysian, which Anheuser-Busch acquired in January.
Not only did the price go up, but the texture tastes, it just tastes normal. It wasn't very unique. I like unique.
Colby Phillips owns Eugene's Tap and Growler, which boasts 45 beer taps, many local. He remembers the brouhaha when Miller Coors bought Hop Valley this year. Yet, Phillips says sometimes news of an indie brewer getting bought pleases patrons.
There's a few that come in and feel like, it's, hey, you know, that's what they're intending to do, and then they're able to achieve their goals, and not necessarily a bad thing.
Most, says Phillips, are neutral or indifferent.
They're like, I care, but it's not something that is first and foremost in my life right now, even in my beer drinking life. I'm just not going to buy 10 barrel. I will buy this Oakshire beer that's locally owned and drink that, enjoy it.
And then there are the vocal few who vow never to buy that beer again. They say they won't support any brewery under a corporate umbrella that sacrifices small batch artisanship for big batch blandness.
Now,
Hop Valley Brewing, a bartender in tie-dye pours IPAs while customers relax in booths and patio tables. Hop Valley co-founder Chuck Hare says their acquisition by Miller Coors wasn't a ready decision.
We were contacted by several other companies prior to conversations with Miller Coors. Immediately, it was off the table. That was something that none of us were really interested in doing at all. As we began to move into other states and grow, we started to kind of realize, hey, this isn't as easy as we think it is here in Oregon. The further you get away from home, it's very, very difficult to sell beer. It's very difficult to do distribution deals.
Harris says it's easier getting business calls returned since signing on with Miller Coors. And Hop Valley's distribution, production, and credibility are all up. He says he's just finished up contracts for hops through 2023, and his company is seeing some of their best sales to date, up nearly 30% from this time last year.
People concerned about giving their money to a big brewery, I get it and I understand it, but I sometimes eat Lock Mead ice cream and sometimes I eat Haagen-Dazs. I hope people do drink our beer. I want everybody to drink it, but there's a ton of great beer, not only here in Oregon and not only here in the Northwest, but in the U.S.
It's also worth noting that Big Beer isn't out to snatch up all microbreweries either. Most acquisitions are geographically plotted to let Big Beer cast the widest regional net for drinkers. With national craft beer sales up nearly 13%, it's a game corporate labels want to get in on. The U.S. Justice Department has put regulations on Anheuser-Busch that will restrict further acquisitions after its $107 billion merger of Saab Miller. Not that other companies haven't been busy. Bart Watson is chief economist for the Brewers Association.
Most of the large players in the U.S. beer market have made acquisitions.
Watson adds there were 4,656 small and independent craft breweries in the U.S. So while media coverage of acquisitions has rattled the brewing world,
the vast majority of small breweries remain independent. So while we have seen a trend in acquisitions, it's worth remembering that 99% of breweries have not been acquired. So there's still probably lots of local independent breweries in your local market.
And many indie breweries plan to stay that way. Eugene's Ninkasi Brewing Company and Oakshire have pledged to keep locally owned, for example. Both turned 10 this year. Still, it hurts many craft beer buffs to see their prize brew sell out. Even the piniest IPA may not take the edge off of that loss. I'm Brian Bull, reporting in Eugene. There's a tear in my beer, 'cause I'm crying for
you, dear. That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of it or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastalradio.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening. Join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.